On Friday morning, high school and college students gathered on the UMKC campus to demand action against climate change. They walked to Brush Creek, where one of our reporters met Avalon Manica, a senior at St. Teresa's. One of her classmates had organized a student walkout so that a bunch of them could go.
So we had permission slips signed by us or by our parents to walk out of our school and walk here to join the protest.
Yeah. Avalon cares a lot about the climate change issue.
Yeah, I just feel like it needs to be taken more seriously, and I feel like this will help kind of like to show like older people especially that this is our issue more than like theirs kind of, so yeah.
This is her first protest, but probably not her last.
But this is like something really important to me, and last year I even went vegetarian to like kind of do my own part in helping like the environment. So yeah, it's something really important to me, so I'll definitely keep like focusing on this and like protesting it.
What might look to older people like radical action on climate change might not look that way at all to up-and-coming generations, to people like Avalon, whose reckoning with climate change probably won't be theoretical. But is that all there is to the generational differences on the issue? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll be digging a little deeper on that. My first guest is Michael Wolf, who spent the week leading up to that protest we just heard emailing me repeatedly, urging me to cover it with earnest pleas on behalf of his generation. He's the press coordinator and Kansas policy advisor for the Sunrise Movement, and he is 24 years old. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. It's nice to finally meet you in person.
Same.
Can you tell me more about what you were doing to get ready for that protest?
I should clarify, I'm with the Sunrise Movement Kansas City Hub, and we spent, you know, the last 6 weeks, meeting high school students, talking to teachers, talking to our partner ally orgs, forming a coalition of labor, communities of color, a tenants' rights organization. We tried to get an immigrants' rights organization, and we were all just kind of coming together to, put together these massive rallies for these climate strikes here in Kansas City.
What was it like? Describe the day for people who weren't there.
Oh, it was fantastic. Between the two rallies, we had over 750 people show up, which I think makes it the largest climate strike in Kansas City history. And it was just amazing to see all the energy, like all of these different people coming together and saying, hey, we need our political leaders to take this seriously. And I think we had a lot of success that day with that, too.
Did you see a lot of people my age and older out there making amends for the condition that we're leaving things in for you guys, or just mostly no high school, college students?
We actually did in the evening rally. So we had two rallies. We had one in the morning on UMKC campus and one in the evening at Mill Creek Park. And we definitely did have a lot of older people at the later rally. And I don't know necessarily that they were making amends, but they were there in solidarity with us because they do care about the issue.
We'll get back to that, but I do want to hear about your own personal journey. You didn't actually plan to be an environmental activist. You moved to LA right out of college with something else in mind, right?
I moved to Southern California to attend film school, and then I lived in LA and worked in the film industry. While I was in school, I was in a chemistry of environmental issues class, and that was right at the same time as the fall 2016 election. So to be in that class and then to see President Donald Trump come in and, to see clearly that we were going to be going in the opposite direction on all of these issues I had just learned about. And then on top of that, right after I had graduated, I actually had to evacuate due to a wildfire near my apartment. And that wildfire gave me a respiratory infection. I got really sick for about the next 2 months, actually. And I took a lot of time off work. And, I didn't have paid time off. I wasn't on my parents' health insurance. And it kind of opened my eyes that, like, when we talk about the climate crisis, we typically talk about, like,
The future.
But it's happening here and now. And so I realized that I couldn't sit by and do nothing anymore. I didn't know what I would do with myself if I didn't make this my priority. And to see in Kansas City that there hadn't, at least to my knowledge, been a lot of action, you know, California.
So this is your hometown.
This is my hometown, exactly. And in California, there is a lot more of a stronger environmental movement. And
can you describe that, like just how you see it as a person living in that place?
See it in California?
Yeah.
I think generally, you know, like there are Democrats in office who make the environment more of a priority. You know, there's composting, there's mixed recycling, you know, available to everybody. There's a smorgasbord of different organizations working on environmental issues from every possible angle. And you compare that to here, there are groups here, but it's just not the same yet.
Kind of quieter?
Yeah.
Do you remember telling parents and other older people in your life that you were going to leave Southern California and leave the film industry to come back and see what you could do about the environment?
I do. You know, and it wasn't an easy decision, and I think they weren't exactly surprised when I told them, because going up to that point, I had been pretty actively concerned about it on just Facebook, but not doing much about it. But I think they were shocked that, you know, I finally decided to make the decision, so to speak.
Do you remember those conversations, just the different points of view that were being expressed?
I think there was some confusion, but I think ultimately, you know, and it was kind of like, oh wait, why are you doing this? Or wow, this sounds really important to you. I had no idea this could be so important to you. And I think since then, there's been a lot of movement, and you know, my parents in particular have really come around on the issue and try to be a lot more aware and a lot more focused about what they can do as people. And you know, me picking up and moving halfway across the country back home really taught them that, like, this is an important problem that needs to be addressed if he's willing to do this.
Something I have noticed in politics, both local and national, is that candidates for office seem to be perceived very differently by different generations, and particularly when it comes to proposals on fighting climate change. So, like, various Green New Deals being proposed right now can look sort of radical or, like, not mainstream to older voters in a way that people who are a bit younger tend to see differently. Like, a lot of younger people see urgent action being totally in proportion to the problem, like that it's an emergency type situation that demands that kind of response. Do you see that disconnect between generations, or am I imagining it?
I think you've actually hit the nail on the head on what the disconnect is. It's worth noting that, you know, I think according to like a recent NPR Mayor's poll back in July, that the Green New Deal does poll really well amongst voters, you know, amongst baby boomers, which is 73 and under. And I think once you get to the silent generations, it's at 49%, which isn't that much lower than what it's polling here in Kansas and Missouri, which is 52% and 53% respectively. But I think it is true that, like, our generation, you know, and this is the big reason the Sunrise Movement was pushing the Democratic National Committee to have a climate change debate, is our generation sees this as the lens through which we need to view all issues, right? To us, it's not climate change is a separate issue on a laundry list of issues. Climate change is healthcare. Climate change is immigration. Climate change is good jobs and a minimum, like a $15 hour minimum wage and unions for all.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. You know, so at the rally, actually, one of our members, Kiana Harris, spoke to her experience growing up in Wyandotte County and dealing with food deserts there. You know, and this is a huge problem because people have to drive more than 2 miles to get to a grocery store to get good, healthy food. And, you know, it's...
And then once it gets to that place, it's already... The food itself has also traveled some distance.
Yeah, the food itself has traveled some distance, but, you know, these... Some people can't afford a car, or if they can't afford a car, they have high car insurance premiums that prevent them from being able to buy, you know, all the food that they need that's healthy and sustainable. And if we fix climate change, right, if we make our cities more walkable, if we provide free public transportation, which is something that at our rally, like Kansas City Councilman Eric Bunch, who backed the Green New Deal at our rally, said he believes is part of a Green New Deal, right? Or if we build affordable housing, you know, that is closer to grocery stores, which is also something that Councilman Bunch mentioned, you know, these are things that greatly intersect, right? And that's what's so cool about the Green New Deal, you know, if you're viewing it in the right way. And some people view it as say it's radical, but to us, we're saying like, no, like equity needs to be the center of the conversation. Like the system that got us all of these injustices before also got us climate change. And we need to, the only way we are going to solve climate change is if we also address all of these issues with it.
Call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation about generational differences around the climate change issue. I want to bring an expert voice in on this, Matthew Ballou, joining us from Yale University. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You are looking into the complexities around this as part of your work for Yale's program on climate change communication. Can you explain that?
Yep. Yeah, so in collaboration with George Mason University, twice a year we conduct nationally representative surveys of the U.S. public. And we decided to take a look into our data for generational differences for a few reasons. So first, previous research has found age differences in beliefs about global warming. For instance, Gallup polls have found a global warming age gap, that younger adults in the U.S. are more worried about global warming than older adults. And also in the U.S., we know that global warming is a politically divisive issue. Pew Research Center has found some evidence that the political divide on beliefs about global warming is narrower among millennials compared to older generations. And in terms of age differences in engagement with global warming, there's been mixed evidence. So about a decade ago, we found in our research that there was some evidence that younger adults may in fact be less engaged with global warming. But clearly times are changing and more young Americans are taking publicly visible action. So this was also a factor in why we decided to check our data.
And so you published this really fascinating study. There are a couple of details that I'd like to dig into with you now. One is, do I understand, and you kind of hinted at this before, but I want to just kind of underline it, that not only do younger people tend to see climate change as an urgent problem, an important political issue, but that they actually view it that way across party lines?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's one of our research questions. We were wondering if younger generations are, quote unquote, narrowing the political divide in global warming opinion. And so we looked at the largest generational segments of the U.S. We looked at millennials, Gen Xers, baby boomers, and the silent generation. And we found that the gap...
Can I just jump in and clarify this term, the silent generation? Who's that?
Yeah. The silent generation, they're born between the years 1928 and 1945.
Why are they called the silent generation?
The silent generation. I'm actually not entirely sure.
Okay. Well, sorry about that. But okay, back to your data.
That's a good question, though. I will look into that. And so, and what we found is that the gap between Republicans and Democrats' core beliefs about global warming is narrower among millennials and wider among older generations. So to break this down a bit, we found that in comparison to older generations of Republicans, more millennial Republicans say global warming is happening, that it is human caused, that most scientists agree that it's happening, or that they are worried about global warming. So for example, we found that 45% of millennial Republicans say they are worried, compared to 31% of baby boomers and 28% of those from the silent generation.
So what, like, to me, I think that this might take some getting used to for people who are just totally accustomed to the idea that there is this huge division politically over climate change and whether global warming is a man-made issue, et cetera. Like, those things that seem to be kind of really polarizing historically, that they're maybe not going forward if you look at it through the generational lens.
Yeah. So what we find is that there may not be clear and consistent generational differences among Democrats. And like what you're saying, and through our data and our results, suggests that there may be less political polarization about the issue among younger adults in the U.S. And this is really good to know, because the younger generations might be able to help build bipartisan support for our climate policies, or help bridge the political divide on climate change.
The way that younger people learn about climate change, get their information about climate change, is also different, according to your research.
Yeah. So this is actually a surprising finding that we found. And so we did some other analyses that we published in the journal Environment. And this is when we were announcing the release of 10 years of our public opinion data to the public. And so we found that compared to older generations, millennials are less likely to discuss global warming with their family and friends, and they're much less likely to hear about it in traditional media. So it's interesting that younger generations may be more worried about global warming, but less likely to talk about it and hear about it in the media.
Yeah, what do you make of that?
That is a really good question, and it's something that future research should definitely dive into. From the research side of things, there isn't much work on explaining age differences. For instance, why is there a differential partisan divide among younger generations compared to older generations?
Michael, what do you think, particularly of this idea that younger generations might be getting actually consuming less news about global warming and talking about global warming less, but more concerned about it and more inclined toward action around it?
I think it's a great question. What I will say, whenever I read the news, it's pretty cut and dry and bleak to say. Like, scientists say we have, according to that UN IPCC report, we have less than 11 years to completely transform, you know, our entire economy away from fossil fuels. And they talk about, you know, these like climate tipping points where eventually, if we don't reduce emissions to a certain point, certain things in our atmosphere, or certain things on our planet, the permafrost will melt and spiral into releasing more emissions and make things worse. So in that sense, it is very terrifying. I also think, you know, when we talk about this generational divide, though, it's important to remember, a good chunk of older people do care about this issue. And the real problem when it comes to like this partisanship that we're talking about is money and politics. And we need to make it clear that, you know, the fossil fuel industry is a big reason why some of these older Democrats in particular have these positions. But we also see younger Democrats have these positions on action on climate change.
Call 816-235-2888 to tell us how your age affects the way you think about climate change, environmental policy, and other forms of action, whether it's lifestyle choices, protests, or whatever. And if you went to a local rally this past Friday and have observations to share, please do. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, Central Standard. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I've been chatting today with a postdoctoral researcher at Yale and a young local activist with the Sunrise Movement about generational disconnects on the climate change issue. We're about to take your calls at 816-235-2888, and you can still call in. But first, I'd like to hear from one more in-studio guest, Stu Schaefer. He teaches sustainable agriculture at Johnson County Community College, so the environment is something he thinks about a lot. And he has his own history with youth activism, but he got mobilized back when the whole climate change idea was new in the 1970s. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Gina.
Talk to me about youth activism on the environment when you were a youth.
Well, you know, I go back to I'm a boomer, so I go back to the first Earth Days. In high school, I, you know, started to become aware of problems with, you know, pollution was what we referred to at that time. So air and water pollution were major concerns.
When you say they were major concerns, how did you feel about them?
Oh, I felt strongly about them. I lived in St. Louis when I was in high school. And, you know, we could smell the coal plants and chemical factories, you know, from across the river, especially on, you know, sort of still summer days. And so the smog was really, you know, an experience.
What are the big changes you've seen when it comes to what's radical, what's mainstream, who's activated, who's not?
Well, I was part of that generation that was radical. and you know, those of us, I think, many of us, not all probably, but many of us have maintained our values through all these years. And so, you know, those of us who, like me, you know, have been concerned with these issues at that level are encouraged by, you know, seeing younger people like Michael getting, you know, activated and getting active and, you know, seeing, you know, the big picture of what needs to be done, which is what radical actually means, is going to the roots. You know, we're encouraged by that. We don't want to, you know, throw it all on them. I know Greta Thunberg made a comment like, you know, we don't want you to see us for hope. We want you to, you know, engage in action. And so, you know, we need to do that as well.
Are you hearing your colleagues, your friends, old people in older generations talking about how to do that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the reasons I'm engaged in sustainable agriculture is, you know, as part of the Back to the Land movement and, you know, committed to ecological farm methods of farming. And those of us working on production of food, you know, are concerned with all these issues that Michael was talking about, with social justice and all being connected. But it all goes to the roots in the soil. And, you know, one of the, you know, primary means we can address climate change is by, you know, getting that carbon out of the atmosphere and back into the soil where, you know, where it does good things rather than harmful things to the climate.
Since you teach this at a community college, I'm wondering what the conversations with your students are like, if anything that you hear from them surprises you.
Not particularly. I think what surprises me is you know, the commitment and passion that people who are coming into our program in particular have. And I guess it sometimes surprises me when I teach classes that are more survey courses in sociology that even there, students are more aware of these issues than they were just a few years ago.
How do you see that passion that you're talking about? How do you discover it? What does it look like?
Right. Well, in my sustainable agriculture classes and with those students, they're moved. They're emotionally committed to what they're doing, and they feel like they have a purpose in working to, you know, grow food in ecological ways and provide food for people that is healthy and benefits, you know, people and the environment at the same time.
And Michael Wolf, that gets back to kind of what you were saying before about what it's like to read the news being a 24-year-old. I could imagine that you have two choices when you read about news regarding climate change, one being to become despondent and apathetic, and the other being to, like, try to change the course of events.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think there's no doubt about it. You're either galvanized by what's happening right now, or you are going to suffer in anxiety and panic and fear over what's happening now and what will come if we don't address this. But what I will say is finding your group does really help. Finding like-minded people that you can be organized with really helps. And the Green New Deal is fantastic because it is a climate change policy that looks at climate change as an opportunity to rectify, you know, a long history of injustice and to lift people out of poverty and to, you know, lift up millions of residents.
It's interesting because recent history, the sort of public conversations about environmentalism have treated it as a conversation that people like with privilege kind of have, and that there is sort of this pitting of environmentalism against like economic survival, that choosing the more sustainable food is expensive and not something that everyone can do, et cetera.
Which is all the more reason why we need a very strong, equitable-based climate policy. You're absolutely right. And I think, you know, scientists say we have less than 11 years to mobilize our economy away from fossil fuels. And, you know, that's going to take the involvement of literally everybody. And so for us to say, like, hey, like, you know, we need you to do this, and we also, for the government to say, we need you to do this, but we are going to ignore all of the problems that you're facing, that's just not fair. And what's cool about the Green New Deal is, like, everybody gets a stake in this mobilization. Everybody gets something out of it. We are going to be investing in the people who are making this transition, which is everyone.
Well, let's talk to our callers. And I want to just say again hello to Matthew Ballou, who's with us from Yale and who will also be here to answer your questions. He knows a lot about the data on generational differences around climate change and climate change action. Matthew, hello again.
Hi.
Okay, so let's hear from our callers. I want to talk to Marissa, who is calling us from Kansas City. Hi, Marissa.
Hello.
What do you want to share? And first of all, let us know how old you are. Don't normally care, but it's relevant to this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm 33. I'm an older millennial, and I think that my personal views on climate change probably tend to fall into what you guys are seeing borne out statistically. It's something that I worry about. It's something that I think needs to be a major part of our political platforms and conversations going forward. The point I wanted to make was that I think that for myself and for a lot of people who I would consider peers, it's become something that you're very worried about on an abstract level, but it is difficult to understand how you can take it on in the context of your day-to-day life. Because, for example, I'm driving right now. I live where I can afford to live, and I work where I have a job. And so I think that we all understand, like, we need to reduce carbon emissions and all of that. But I think what gets taken out of this conversation a lot is what we need to be doing on a local political level to address some of the things that make it hard for people to live in a climate-friendly way on a day-to-day basis.
Well, Marissa, thank you for that call. And do you have thoughts about this piece of it that we were hearing from Matthew, that people your age are very worried but tend not to be, like, the ones posting to social media about it or, like, for lack of a better term, grandstanding?
I think it depends. I think that there are people who are my age who are very engaged in social media, who use that space as sort of their platform and where they have their voice. But I also think two things. One, I think maybe people who 5, 6, 10 years ago had grown up with social media and were using it a lot to share political opinions, I think that there's sort of a political opinion fatigue with social media, where many people my age just don't use it much at all anymore. And then to his point, and then also to what I was saying, yeah, I think we're all very worried about it, but it's also, you have bills to pay, you have kids you have to have in daycare. I mean, you've got all this stuff going on, and it's hard to find, even though you understand on a macro level that if we don't fix it, our kids who we're worrying about daycare for now will be worrying about much bigger things for in 10 or 15 years. You still have to figure out how to make it work and function within the life you have to live.
Well, Marissa, thank you so much for that call. I want to turn to Matthew. Matthew, do you have statistical like understanding of some of the issues Marissa's getting at, because I totally see what she's saying, that as worried as you may be about the long term, you still have to contend with what's right in front of you today.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't know if I can speak much to that in terms of the data that we have available. But we do find, at least in our latest surveys, in our 2018-2019 surveys, that younger generations are expressing more motivation to be engaged. So, for instance, we found that millennials, compared to older generations, say that global warming is personally important to them and express a willingness to contact government officials about global warming. So that motivation seems to be there, but like Marissa was saying, that there has to be more concrete, tangible solutions that younger generations can grasp onto, that organizations can reach them with to better engage them and give them these opportunities that they can use.
Michael, jump in here.
Well, you know, I would say finding your local groups that you can volunteer with, even if it's an hour a week, if you can donate some money to, helps a ton. One of the things that we're pushing here in Kansas City is a local version of the Green New Deal. We actually, at the climate strike, we ran into Mayor Quentin Lucas, who just signed on and endorsed the Green New Deal after marching with us. And, you know, part of that part of the conversation that we're going to be having with him that we need more people at the table for is, you know, what these local policies are going to look like. So free public transportation, affordable housing, you know, the social equity issues in my conversations with city officials so far have been the biggest role. And what Marissa's talking about is exactly right. You know, people have bills to pay. People have all of these other concerns. And, you know, good government. And if we do this right, we can alleviate those concerns. And what we need people to be doing is getting involved, to be voting on this issue, to be encouraging other people to be voting on the issue, and to organize, to show up, to and there's a lot of different ways that that can look like. But sitting by and doing nothing, it isn't enough. We need you to talk about it. We need you to get involved and do more.
Let's talk to Alex in Independence. Hi, Alex. Alex, are you there? Okay, maybe Alex is not there. Let's talk to Jan. Jan is calling from KC North. Hi, Jan.
Hi. Yeah, as a 70-year-old who, you know, I have my own home I hope to live in for a long time yet, but it runs on propane. I have restricted income. I have two cars that I'm trying to keep alive and use them as little as possible, but, you know, they're very cheap to run. I would love to have an electric car, convert my house over to a heat pump and solar or something, but I can't afford it. There's no way that somebody like me can afford to do that without, you know, major grant subsidies or something from some kind of setup. And so I get frustrated sometimes wishing I could do more besides take cloth bags to the store and use the car as little as possible, and sometimes, you know, walk that 2 miles up to a bus thing, you know, which there's nothing much up here in the north side, running east and west and connecting, you know, at various hours during the day, so that our bus traffic is kind of limited to a few north-south routes.
Well, you know,
anyway,
Jan, thank you so much for that call.
My point.
Yeah, thank you. And Stu, as you listen to Jan, do you hear this kind of thing a lot when you're talking with friends about the environment?
Well, you know, my friends are pretty involved with the environment, whether it's gardening or, you know, doing their part, or, you know, voting for politicians who will support the kinds of policies that somebody like Jan could benefit from, mass transit, better mass transit.
It is interesting that we've gotten into, as sort of Michael was alluding to, issues that people might not think of as climate change issues, but transit, like local policy,
definitely,
where the buses do and don't run.
Right. Subsidizing energy efficiency and renewable energy on homes rather than subsidizing fossil fuel companies. You know, that would go a long way to benefiting people in her position.
We're going to have to go in a second, but since we have people representing different generations around the table right now, I wonder if each of you, Stu and Michael, if you could say what you would like for people in across the generational divide to hear, no matter what their position is on climate change, to just sort of hear about your perspective?
I'll say two things to this point. Number one, I think not all of the politicians that are elected right now are our friend. A lot of them take money from fossil fuel executives and corporations that want to keep the status quo where it is. And that includes a lot of Democrats, and we need to be vigilant about that. And number two, again, climate change isn't about, you know, taxing you more or banning, you know, flying or encouraging you to drive less. Like, ideally, we want to fly less and drive less and eat less meat. But climate change right now is an extreme opportunity to really change our society and how we live into a better one. And the one that, you know, going back to the civil rights movement and before that, to FDR's New Deal that we have been fighting for.
Stu, what would you like to say across the generational divide?
We do a great job as a people in coming together in disasters. I think what people of all generations need to recognize is that we're in the throes of a disaster now, and so we need to pull together and work together.
Stu Schaefer, Michael Wolf, thank you for joining me in studio this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
And Matthew Ballou with us from Yale, thank you.
Thank you for having me, too.
Up next, new county-by-county research on people's commutes has identified a county in Missouri with a high concentration of super commuters, that is, people who commute 90 minutes or more for work each day, 90 minutes one way. Stay tuned for that conversation next. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're going to talk about super commuters, people who travel 90 minutes or more to work. And that's 90 minutes one way. So these are folks who spend 3 hours in transit on a daily basis. Some new data drills down into a national spike in super commuting county by county, and it reveals a couple of interesting things. One is, as you'd expect, there's a lot of super commuting going on for people who live in exurbs, that is, places on the fringe of a metro that used to be towns in their own right that have been absorbed into suburban sprawl. People who live in exurbs now tend to work in the city, and they have the commutes to show it. But the surprising piece is there are also lots of super commuters living in urban cores. And that's because commuting by public transit can take a really long time, even when you're not going very far. Call 816-235-2888 if you are a super commuter and tell us why you do it, how it affects your life. 816-235-2888. Let's start with some perspective from Karen Clausen. She's the air quality and rideshare manager at the Mid-America Regional Council, or MARC. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. What is the average commute in Kansas City?
The average commute time is about 23, 24 minutes. So that's people driving. That's not going by transit.
How do people typically commute? So, like, that is typically by car, as you've said, but do we see other, like, complexities in the picture of commuting in our metro?
Sure. I mean, most people drive alone, right? Census information tells us that about 83-84% of people are driving alone. So that's a lot of people, a lot of excess capacity in cars that, you know, where people could be carpooling and taking other people to work with them. And about 8.4% of people are carpooling. So that's two or more people in a car. And then we have, you know, people who are working from home. And I bet in the next census that we see coming out of 2020, that information might show that more people are working from home. Right now, that's about 5%. And I think that's a really interesting statistic as, you know, more companies are starting to realize, you know, that they can offer that flexibility to people. So when it comes to public transit, about 1.1% of people are using public transit to get to work in the region.
You know, I'm curious about whether we see the kinds of long public transit commutes in the Kansas City area that the national data have revealed in urban areas throughout the country.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, talking about, you know, super commuting specifically, so about 1% of the workforce in our region currently is what we call super commuting, that 90-minute or more commute. And you know, I suspect a lot of those people are, you know, public transit riders. And so I just did some, you know, research to see, you know, what are some examples of those type of public transit commutes that are really, really long. And so some examples, and, you know, these are, you know, if you were going by car, these type of commutes or trips would only take about 25 minutes. But if you're going from here, UMKC area, to Johnson County Community College, maybe you're a student who's taking classes in both locations.
Or our last guest, who is probably headed back that way.
Yeah. But, so you would maybe – you could take one bus if you wanted to, which is great because a lot of times you do have to transfer between buses. That would be about a 90-minute trip. It really would. And that includes 15 minutes of walking, of course. But again, 23 minutes by car to make that trip. If you were going from Crown Center, maybe you lived around there or worked and you were going to the airport for a conference or something, that is also a 90-minute commute, but that would only take 25 minutes to travel by car. So
when we talk about super commuting, and we do recognize that there's one version of the super commute, which is the extended public transit ride, but that there's usually what we're talking about is a long drive.
Sure.
How much super commuting by car do we see in the KC Metro and in Kansas and Missouri more broadly?
So it's hard to tell with the census data that we have, but I would say probably over half. We know some
over half. What do you mean?
So over half of the super commuting trips are likely by car. A good share of them are transit, but yeah, there's still a lot of people who are coming in from the further reaches of our region, outside of our region, to get to jobs in the Kansas City area, and a lot of those trips are likely for construction jobs that tend to move people around. So people are not always commuting kind of to the same location every day, but moving to different jobs. But yeah, you might have people, you know, coming in from Sedalia or Emporia or even further out. So
do you see this as like having an economic and development kind of explanation, or is the explanation something else?
You know, there's a lot of possible explanations. I think, you know, if you are choosing to live further out from the region, you know, the type of jobs that you're going after, and I mentioned construction, that might be one of the reasons that's pulling you towards those longer commutes. another explanation could be that, you know, maybe you have a two-career household and, you know, the other person in your household needs to, you know, reside in a, you know, further out community, and your career options are mostly in, you know, the urban core for some reason. So there's a lot of different reasons people will do this, and some of it's economic driven and some of it's just kind of family preferences and that type of thing.
But that does, what you described, does get at an economic development thing, which is that if one person has a job in a more remote area, then but the general job opportunities in that place are not great, then that leaves the other person in the household, if they also need to be earning an income, that leaves them with the option of working from home, perhaps, but commuting more likely.
Right, right. That's absolutely true. So, yeah, and it, you know, it impacts, you know, the economy. It impacts family. I'm sure it's not a small decision that people make to, you know, to do that type of commuting, because commuting, you know, it can be an unpleasant experience, of course. And we like to look at, you know, transportation happiness and as a goal. You know, we want people to be.
What does that mean? Transportation happiness.
Yeah. So, you know, transportation, especially when we're talking about commuting just by its nature is not something that people really want to do. People don't want to have long commutes. But there's actually been some studies out there that have shown that certain modes of transportation make people happier, but there's some criteria in there as well. So people generally want their commute to be short, so they're going to have a higher transportation happiness level if their commute is short, is not congested, is not crowded if they're riding public transit. But generally, I think what some of these studies are seeing is that, okay, shorter commutes are better, but also commutes that have an active transportation component to them.
What does that mean?
So that means, if you have, biking or walking integrated into your commute, you're more likely to be satisfied. Exercise, of course, can make people happier, generally improve your mood. And that also translates in the workplace to higher productivity. People who are able to also work during their commute tend to think that their commute is a little more pleasant. So whether that's, doing a little bit of work, if you're carpooling, maybe you're not the driver that day, or if you're using public transit.
We're planning on hearing from someone else in just a moment, but I looked at this interactive map put out by apartmentlist.com where you can see the super commuting rates at the county level. And the county that jumped out on this map for having really high rates of super commuters, and by high within our region, I mean 10% of the population drives 90 minutes or more to work one way. St. Clair County, Missouri is the one that comes up. Can you talk, what do you know about that county? Or just, it is about 90 minutes from Kansas City.
Yeah, so for people who don't know where St. Clair County is, and I had to look that up myself because it's not part of our immediate region that Mark plans for. So it's just south of Clinton, Missouri. That's a far drive. I don't know much about, the makeup of the people in that county, but it is a more rural county. And so job opportunities there are not as plentiful as, what we have and enjoy in the Kansas City region.
Well, we have just a moment to speak with Teresa Heckenlively, who is the economic developer for St. Clair County. She's joining us now. Teresa, hello.
Hello.
Are you surprised to hear that your county is exceptional for its number of super commuters within the region?
I am not. we're a population of about 9,300, and 26% of our population commutes, a large percentage of our population commutes at least 26 miles, and 10% of our population commutes 90 and more.
Why do people travel so far for their jobs? Because the factors that I would imagine contributing to that, you wouldn't be alone. It seems like something really profound or extreme is going on.
Sure. Well, I think there is a movement right now where people are wanting to get out of larger communities and into smaller communities. We have a higher than average population of aging in place, and so we're getting people that are getting ready to retire or are retired that still may want to keep their feet a little wet in the job markets or be prepared to retire. And so they're coming to our smaller rural areas.
So it's new
where there's
residents.
More outdoor recreation.
Not people who have lived there for a long time and are so committed that they can't bear to move closer to their jobs. Teresa? I don't hear Teresa. Perhaps we don't have a great connection to this 90-mile-minute away county. Karen, jump in here. Are you surprised by her explanation?
Not totally. I think that, I'm maybe not seeing the connection with aging in place so much, but people, are interested in living in all sorts of places, and so that county in particular is kind of, it's almost, halfway between here and Springfield. And so there's a lot of job opportunities if you're willing to travel, that length of time. So that could be a reasonable explanation for that.
Okay, Teresa, we have to go, but I want to give you one last chance to very quickly tell me, do you see it? A day coming when more employers might come to St. Clair so that people aren't commuting so far?
Absolutely. We're definitely in an age where the jobs are coming to where the employees are. And so we're setting us up for more industry and more job opportunities here in St. Clair County.
Well, thank you, Teresa. We've got to go. Karen Clausen with us from the Mid-America Regional Council, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Teresa Heckin-Lively joining us from St. Clair County, Missouri, where they're looking to attract big employers so that people don't have to commute so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is a wrap. You can find both of this morning's conversations later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. The show is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, and intern Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.